Chapter 2 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 2. It was, I think, a great misfortune for our family that we lived so little in Scotland on our own place. The happiest days of my childhood were passed at Kinmount, which is about 4 miles from Annan, and to this day I sometimes dream that we are going back there. We left the place, forever as it turned out, when I was about 10 years old, and by the time I was 17 it had passed out of the possession of the family, and the 800 years' identification of the Douglases with that part of Scotland, which is bounded on the south side by the Solway Firth, was finished. The other part of the property, the Torthorwald estate, had already been sold, and nothing was then left in the way of houses and land but a small place called Glen Stewart and about 2,000 acres, which in turn were sold almost immediately after my brother Percy succeeded my father. Percy and I were always particular friends, and were, so to speak, paired off together in everything right up to the time when he went into the navy. We rode about on our ponies together, our favourite objective being the little village of Ecclefechan, the birthplace of Carlyle, where there was a small shop which dealt in such commodities as wooden swords and gold-leaf paper, most of our games being connected with battles and frays. The estate carpenter, Dunkeld, kindest of men, used to make us wooden spears and shields on which the Douglas heart was painted, and a thrust directed by Percy from one of these spears on one occasion missed putting out my elder brother's, Drumlanrig's, eye by a fraction of an inch. Then came the sad day when we moved out of Kinmount and went up to London, first to 67 Cromwell Road and afterwards to 18 Cadogan Place. My father, even in those days, had ceased to live at home. He had rooms in James Street, Buckingham Gate, and we hardly ever saw him either in London or at my mother's country house, The Hut, 3 miles from Bracknell, in Berkshire, which we inhabited during the summer months. The Hut was a picturesque, rambling ranch of a house, larger than its name might imply. At a pinch it would hold quite 25 people, which had been run up by Lord Downshire in the pine woods as a temporary abode while his big place, East Hampstead, was being built. At the time when we lived there, Artie Downshire, the late Marquis, was a boy about the same age as myself, and he and his mother were our nearest neighbours, as well as our landlords. Artie was an amiable, though rather stolid, boy, and he had a positive mania for driving farm carts. His poor mother's desperate attempts to induce him to take his proper part in the elaborately organised cricket matches in the park at East Hampstead, at which my 3 brothers and myself were, of course, usually present, were continually being frustrated. When Artie's turn to go in arrived, he had generally disappeared, and he was found later on seated on the shaft of a manure cart, admonishing the cart horse to gee up. His cousin, Wellington Stapleton Cotton, who would have become Lord Combermere if he had lived, was a frequent guest at East Hampstead. There was a tremendous friendship between him and me. I adored him, and I think he adored me. He was at school at Wellington College when I was at Winchester, and I remember on one occasion, when I had been off in the summer holidays to Switzerland, Zermatt, in the company of my housemaster, Trant Bramston, and my great school friend Encombe, Lord Eldon's eldest son, I returned to the Hut and developed mumps just a week before the day on which Wellington and I were due to go back to our respective schools. It was a bitter blow to us both when he was, of course, forbidden to come over from East Hampstead to see me. However, I wrote him a note, dispatched by the trusty hand of Harold, the footman, in which I pointed out that if he could only manage to catch the mumps, we would no doubt be allowed to be together for the next 3 weeks, and I begged him to come up to see me in spite of the prohibition of Lady Downshire and my mother. The next morning he turned up before breakfast and got into my bedroom through the window. We decided that the best way to ensure the desired infection of the mumps was for him to undress and get into bed with me. This he did, and after remaining with me for half an hour, he departed, as he had come, an undiscerned road, by the window. The cussedness of things was, however, exemplified in the usual way, for he failed to develop the slightest symptom of the dread disease, whereas Encombe went back to Winchester and infected our house, who in turn passed it on to the rest of the school. At that time I was 15, and Wellington a year younger. The last time I saw him was about 4 years later, when he came over to dine and sleep from Sandhurst. He was killed at Spion Kop in the Boer War. I have never forgotten to pray for him every night since his death, and I look forward to being a boy again with him in paradise, one day not very far off. When you go to heaven, you can be what you like, and I intend to be a child. At home, by my brothers and sister, and by all my relatives, I was always called Bosie, and the name has stuck to me all my life. Its origin is simply that my mother called me so when I was a baby. Obviously, it is just a variation of boy, and means little boy. When I had been about a year at Winchester, my brother Percy, who was then a midshipman in the Navy, happened to send me a farewell telegram just as he was starting in his ship for the Pacific. It contained the words, "Goodbye, darling Bosie." This telegram was put for me on the table in Hall, in my house. I was not in Hall when the telegram arrived, and it was opened by inquisitive boys. When I came in, I was hailed with derisive shouts of, "Hello, darling Bosie," and from that day forth I was always called Bosie by the boys in my house, and later by my housemaster, the Reverend John Trant Branston, and at Oxford the name stuck to me, as it does to this day. Searching back in the dim past for memories of childhood, one flits past a procession of the ghosts of governesses, nurses, and maids. I think all our governesses were more or less beloved. We were very affectionate and sentimental children. To each other we were always darling, as much as a matter of course as we were to my mother. My mother was something I despair of describing. She was so beautiful that just after her marriage, when she and her sister, Mrs. Finch of Burley on the Hill, went driving in London in the park, people stood on chairs to see them. My mother was very fair, and her sister very dark. There is an angelic picture of the two sisters when they were children, painted by Watts for my grandfather, Alfred Montgomery, and it is now at Burley on the Hill. My mother went on looking like a girl till she was well over 40. She had angel's beauty, a gentle, sad, proud, tiny, flower-like face and head, with a slim figure like a Tanagra statuette. She was, and is, the most unselfish, the most incredibly good and sweet and kind and patient, and also the most valiant and loyal woman that ever drew the breath of life. Good as she was, she lacked the one thing to make her a perfect mother, which she has obtained since. I mean that she was not definitely religious. Her mother, the Honourable Mrs. Alfred Montgomery, who was a daughter of the first Lord Leconfield, became a Catholic. She was a convert of Manning, who at one time was rector of Pulborough, close to Petworth, her father's house. And she was, most wickedly and cruelly, separated from her children in consequence. My mother was brought up in the Low Church Protestantism, which more or less afflicted my own childhood, and which was the religion of the creme de la creme of society in those days. I suppose my mother, naturally enough, couldn't swallow it, and so she was not religious, and never gave us any very definite religious teaching. We went to church regularly, of course, unless we could manage to get out of it, and she gave us an example of a holy, blameless, and saintly life. But even all that does not make up for a real religion. My mother became a Catholic in her 80th year. My father, on the other hand, was a professed and crude agnostic, and went out of his way to advertise the fact on every occasion. In fact, anyone he could get to listen to him, he bored to tears about it, and in the end society, which cares very little about religion, but which will not stand being bored, turned on him and avoided him. But to get back to the governesses, the earliest recollection I have of them takes the shape of a somewhat dour and formidable Scotswoman, Miss McCormick. But fortunately, or perhaps unfortunately for me, I did not come under her regime except for a very short time. She belonged to the old-fashioned school, and went in for old-fashioned schoolroom discipline, ranging from the back of a hairbrush to a cane inflicted on the raw. I have distinct recollections of the first-named form of correction, but I was too young during her reign to experience the second. My two elder brothers, on the other hand, had the full benefit of her Spartan system for several years, my mother, of course, not being aware of it. It certainly did them no harm, and as they were both quite devoted to Miss McCormick, I don't imagine they would ever have given her away. Her severities, which were, of course, well known to all the nurses, nursemaids, schoolroom maids, and so forth, eventually produced a rumpus, and Miss McCormick fell a victim to the advancing tide of humanitarianism, which is undermining the moral character of the rising generation. She went, not unwept, by her victims. Others followed, and I particularly remember Miss Smelt, whom I adored, and on whose lap I used to sit while she told me the most wonderful fairy stories, which she invented as she went on, and which lasted for days and days. There was also poor Miss Holland, who took a gloomy view of life, and mistakenly took our mischievous pranks for hostility to herself, and in some ways we must have been very trying, for, with all our sentimentality and our darlings and facile tears, we were distinctly rough and occasionally violent boys. There was a French governess to whom we were devoted, Mademoiselle de Saubourin, and I also remember a Miss Humphrey, whom I loved deeply. Then there was dear Lizzie, my mother's maid, the most faithful, loving soul that ever inhabited a mortal body, and who, though she never was our nurse, takes in our family the place of the nanny of tradition. Needless to say, she also reposes in my prayers, with her sister Ruthie. One of the advantages of being a Catholic is that when anyone you love dies, you put him into your prayers, and keep him there ever afterwards. On one occasion, when my younger brother, Sholto, was 5 years old, he was for some reason left alone in the house with a specially engaged governess for a few weeks. When my mother returned, this governess, whose name I forget, came to see her, and gave formal notice that she wished to leave at once. My mother asked the reason, and the governess gravely replied that it was impossible for her to remain in the house a moment longer, as Lord Sholto had called her a liar. To about the same period belongs the episode of the odd man at Kinmount, whose duties were to clean the boots and knives, and also to wait on the upper servants in the housekeeper's room. When he had been in the house a few days, the butler, a most stately person, addressing my mother, said, "If your ladyship has no objection, we propose to call the new man the usher of the hall." As dear old Joe Graham, my grandfather's and father's huntsman, said to me years afterwards, when I turned up to see him in his cottage at Cummertrees one day, and he instantly recognised me, although he had not seen me for 10 years, because, as he said, I had my father's smile, "they was the days." End of chapter 2.